Okay, settle down, everybody.
I always like to say that.
Oh, what happened to my... Oh.
I went to sleep. No, it just went to sleep, that's all.
Yeah. No, no, it was this. No, it has batteries. Just went to sleep. Welcome, everybody. Just a few administrative things. As you know, I sent out an email telling you that Simon Ann will be due on Monday by 5 p.m., and you can stop by my office or put it under my door if I'm not there, Terman 567. Hope everybody is well along with that, and we'll... take the extra days to refine and improve and proofread your document to make it even better. Any questions on that assignment? Okay. And next Thursday, the 12th, is when we're going to have the midterm presentations for people working on projects. And it'll just be for the people working on projects, no community people. So it'll just be, we'll just have informal discussions. And as I mentioned in my email, anything that you can, that project teams can bring to show me their progress would be great. Sketches, little prototypes, whatever. Okay, any questions?
Yeah.
Probably not. Okay. So we have some handouts today. I don't know how much trouble I went through to get those handouts made. So, yesterday I attended a PhD defense, and it was pretty interesting. There was a couple comments in there that I would like to share with you about the design process. And this is Philip Skogstad. He works with Professor Leifer in ME113 and has been in the course for a long time. And he had a couple insights. The first one that we all sort of already knew, that the earlier build and test prototypes, the better off you are, the better outcome a project team has. So I want to reinforce that concept and encourage people working on projects to start prototyping early and with the knowledge that it may take you three different iterations to get to the point where you can build something that will really work. So the wrong way to do it is to have an idea in mind and just, you know, sort of single-mindedly go toward that goal. But you need to be flexible and try a lot of things in order to figure out what's going to work well. The other thing is a little bit more esoteric. And this is in regard to that some of the top-performing teams in ME310 despite advice to the contrary from reviewers or experts. So this is sort of strange. So he suggests that this means that reviewers or experts may knowingly or unknowingly censor what they're saying to you to lead you in maybe perhaps the wrong direction. I'm not sure what message I can give you from that. I hesitate to say, you know, don't listen to the people that you've been working with as far as your projects, but try to use whatever gut feelings you have in this regard. And as I mentioned before, it's also good to talk to a number of people because the broader view you get about your project needs, the better off you're going to be. Any discussion, questions about this? Basically what you want to do is keep your receipts, and I'll tell you how to get reimbursed for that. Right. Well, if you need to buy something by a credit card, something more substantial, there's a way to do that. If you can be reimbursed for out of pocket expenses. Okay, two ways. Okay, so we're going to continue our discussion on questions for contemplation. And the first one you probably already know. In a marathon race, it used to be that the wheelchair racers started at the end because they took more time and weren't as fast as the elite runners. But these days, because of improvements in wheelchair design, the wheelchairs are much better, and the people are more trained, and the wheelchair athletes start first, and they finish much faster than even the elite runners. So I guess that's due to the success of the mechanical design of the wheelchairs, right? And you may not know that there's been some studies that workers with a disability are, on the average, have better attendance than able-bodied workers. And this sort of connects with what we're talking about on Tuesday about disabled people being healthy. And a lot of times, you know, they are to the point where, they have very good performance on the job. But the two things I want to really discuss are these things down here. Are people with disability really suffering or afflicted? You hear that all the time in the news, even now. And it's something that was brought up in one of my email discussions, and I've really become sort of sensitive to it now. I mean, my thought is that, you know, after you've had some kind of accident and you're hurting all the time, you know, you're... that part of the process you're suffering. But if you're medically stable and you're not in pain, maybe you're not suffering. I mean, there's a lot of things that we certainly may want to improve about ourselves. You know, I mean, am I suffering because I'm older than I was? Am I suffering because I need to wear contact lenses? Am I suffering because I don't have blonde hair and blue eyes, or, you know, whatever? So, and anybody have any thoughts about this? The other thing that really gets me is you hear it, and this is even more common, that people who are wheelchair users are confined to their wheelchairs. And that's a really bad term, because it's actually... in my mind, the opposite is true. Without a wheelchair, a person is basically immobile. So the wheelchair is really a method of providing mobility. So with the wheelchair, you can go a lot of places that you wouldn't have been able to go if you didn't have a wheelchair. So it's actually a liberating device rather than a confining device. So that's way off. Any discussion, comments, thoughts, feelings? Top of the head remarks. Owen?
There's a fantastic video on YouTube that I actually linked to from Active Action Sports of a 14-year-old boy in a wheelchair doing a backflip in a skate park.
On his wheelchair?
In his wheelchair.
Oh, wow.
And he was the first person to come on the videos before records for being the first person to do a backflip in a wheelchair. Now, could any of us do that?
No.
So he has an ability that we don't have through being in a wheelchair.
That's pretty amazing.
With the people I've worked with in sit skis, I think they're sit ski. They can't go anywhere near as well as they can in sit
right. ski. Next month we're going to have Peter Axelson here, and he's done a lot of work in designing skiing and sledding systems for people with disabilities. So that ought to be something that definitely should look forward to. Any other comments before we move on? Any questions on anything that has been said, or like a guess not. Well, next Tuesday is going to be another really good lecture. This is my old colleague of mine, TV Rahman, who now works at Google. He's worked at IBM, and he's worked at Adobe, and he is out of Cornell. So he's going to be talking about eyes-free interaction. I think he's going to be talking about the Google phone, in regard to the Google phone. But you'll see he's a very intelligent and talented researcher. So don't miss that. But today, we're very lucky to have Dr. Eric Sabelman. He was a colleague of mine for many years at the VA. And Eric is the founder of Prozoics Research, which has been engaged in biomedical design and consulting since 79. And as I mentioned, he was on the staff at the VA at the Rehab R&D Center there with me, where he worked on wearable computers for the human body motion analysis, acute spinal cord injury patient care, and tissue engineering for nerve repair and reconstructive surgery. He is an adjunct lecturer at Santa Clara University in mechanical engineering, and he's also affiliated here at Stanford in the biodesign program. He's going to discuss his current work at Kaiser Permanente on deep brain stimulation for the treatment of Parkinson's. There was a very good program on Tuesday night on PBS about Parkinson's, where they had family members. There was a father and two brothers who had Parkinson's, and one of the brothers is a reporter, and so he was sort of interviewing himself and his family and other people, and it was quite interesting. And I'll send you a link to that PBS broadcast, and I think you can see it online. So in that whole program, they talked about non-surgical treatment and the value of exercise, but Eric will talk about the surgical options. So please welcome Eric Sabelman.
Show and tell things, but I think we'll...
Okay, we'll leave the show and tell till afterwards, but I'll pass around these brochures from the Kaiser program that I'm part of now, having left the VA. And one of the things that I told our students that we would be counseling at the VA is that you can't do biomedical engineering just in the lab. You have to get out into the clinic. Well, now I'm having to walk the walk. I used to talk the talk. And we really do get into the clinic, and we really do run into those problems that that having real patients presents. Okay, forward is there. Okay, this is x-ray of one of our patients. He has what looks like a heart pacemaker, except the heart is right here. And the wire doesn't go from the pacemaker to the heart. It goes up to the brain, and that's basically what we're going to be talking about today, why and how you make connections to the brain. And the brain is an input-output device from our point of view. The outputs are controlling your muscles. You can do this, if you have to do this artificially, it's possible to do that by stimulating the brain. You can control speech, perhaps. You can control one's environment from the brain going outward. The inputs to the brain are the normal senses that we have, some of which might be impaired. But you might also have pain, neuropathic pain due to a stroke. You might have epilepsy, which is an internal feedback failure in the brain. And you may have lost neurons, either due to trauma or due to disease processes like Parkinson's disease. And you might have some abnormal feedback that alters your behavior. And this is one of the more controversial applications of deep brain stimulation. So much so that we haven't done any in Kaiser yet. So other people are experimenting with the ability to control emotions. Every medical talk has to have something with that looks soft and gooey. And so here's a picture that I downloaded on a cortical surface mapping. So here they're putting an array of these dime size electrodes and measuring the sort of averaged neuron output from underneath those as part of a diagnostic workup for epilepsy. The CS here is the central sulcus, and on one side you have a motor strip that controls the body, and the other side you have the matching sensory strip. So all of those things are important, and I actually studied this getting my degree, learning the different parts of the brain and the cranial nerves and all of this, and I actually paid attention to it. I'm fortunate I did, because now I have to know this stuff. Some of the things that are being done with regard to getting outputs from the cortex are making little arrays of electrodes that are very small. This is a 2-millimeter scale here, and this is flipped over and sort of punched down into the surface of the brain, and if you happen to hit a neuron with one of these little spikes, then you can record from it. And they're building bigger and bigger arrays of these little spikes, none of which are really good for a long term. I mean, they might be good for several months, but they are used in the clinic for this kind of experimental work. So if your brain really is miswired, if something's not working right, we'll talk about how to control it better. And how do you control your brain? Well, the medical industry is set up for doing things pharmacologically. And so if there's a drug that will help you, they'll research it and provide you with a pill or an injection or something. Or in the case of spinal pain, you can get an infusion pump that continuously pumps pain-relieving medication in. What we're going to talk about mainly, though, is these surgically implanted prostheses, and briefly mention the possibility of regeneration. These are really two antithetical methods for treating this kind of disease. Either you put a prosthesis in that substitutes for the lost function, or you try to restore the lost function with a living replacement. There are all kinds of downloadable pictures of deep brain stimulation, which is what I'm mainly going to be concerned about. So that's deep in the brain rather than the cortical regions that are shallow, and only briefly mention the peripheral nervous system as well. This illustration is from an article on using deep brain stimulation to awaken somebody out of a coma. And so this particular region in the brain has to do with the attention center that, when you switch it off, means you never wake up. Switch it back on again, and it starts the whole process. This is basically this region is really, you know, the boot code for the human brain. The problems with drugs, particularly these drugs for controlling motor function, is they have side effects, and they tend to become less effective over time. So this diagram shows that you start off treating with L-DOPA or variations on that for Parkinson's, and you can control the symptoms fairly well. But over the matter of a few years, you end up either building up dyskinesias, which are the abnormal motion because you've been exposed to this for a long time, or it simply becomes less effective and the symptoms reoccur much more frequently, until finally this window just really doesn't exist anymore. You might get half an hour's worth of benefit from a drug that used to provide you with half a day's benefit. And that's when the indication for this neuroprosthesis really comes into play. We'll look briefly at stem cells. This is a picture which actually showed up in the PBS show very briefly, but this is a multiply stained outgrowth from a clump of neurons showing the neural stem cells showing the axons growing out to mate or to merge and innervate another clump of cells over here. It's a very easy thing to do in a petri dish. The animals that you use might be something like the zebrafish, where you can actually look right into the animal and see these things glowing. But in humans, this is a lot more difficult. There have been clinical trials of stem cell implants for Parkinson's disease. One of the largest in this country, using fetal cells from spontaneously aborted fetuses to avoid all the issues about culturing stem cells, was reported on in 2001, and they used a needle on each side of the brain sliding into the brain from the front, the same technique that I'm going to describe, except the site is different. And they injected some fetal stem cells into a region of the brain called the putamen. And the outcome was actually fairly good in that about two-thirds of the people got some reduction of their symptoms, some of them very good. Another group of people had no effect, which probably meant that the cells didn't survive. And another group of people, 10 out of 70, I think, had new symptoms appear. They had uncontrollable facial motion instead of arm motion. Okay, and that's because these fetal cells, first of all, followed back up the needle tract. So instead of a little clump of cells, they had this long strip of cells going through multiple layers of the brain. And they're the ones that are stained brown in these pictures. Two of the patients had died from car accidents or heart attacks or something, and they were able to do histology on their brains. So these cells survived, but they made connections all over the place. So that's one of the risks of the this kind of surgery using stem cells that you can't really control. Yes?
This is kind of a basic question, but how does the brain respond to, like these probes and needles being stuck into
it? Okay, we'll talk about that. Good. And part of my job is to make sure we don't stick it in some place it shouldn't be. Okay, so there are definitely places you can't put a probe or an electrode because they're life-dependent functions go right through that region, and if you mess them up, they're gone. The same for blood vessels and blood supply. You very carefully map a pathway that avoids all the major blood vessels. You do have some adult stem cells, and these are potentially useful because you could extract your own stem cells and culture them and allow them to proliferate before being reimplanted. And so this is a potentially useful way of obtaining stem cells that bypasses the whole problem of embryonic stem cells. Back, though, on our main topic on hardware rather than wetware, there's a number of different things that you can use brain stimulators for. One is in replacing the sensory function that's been lost. Another is in replacing local motor function, like the in the upper limb. And a specific set of different kinds of techniques for preventing epileptic feedback and seizures. And then further down the spinal cord, well, you have spinal stimulators that go in at the base of the brain, of the spine for lower back pain. It's a fairly benign sort of thing, and the surgeon I work with does a fair number of these things. But in fact, it's a much easier surgery since you don't have this problem of having to locate a particular region. You just slide the electrode in next to the spinal cord. While at the VA, I looked at the Bion, which is an injectable stimulator that basically is addressed externally. And this version is inductively powered, so you can stimulate a muscle by injecting one of these little stimulators into it and sending a pulse down to it that's coded for that particular one. And then another fairly common treatment is vagal nerve stimulation, and you can see the electrodes wrap around the vagus nerve. There's a problem there in that the electrodes, in order to get them to stick, have to be wrapped fairly tightly, and they grow onto onto the nerve, so you can't remove them. Okay, so if the thing fails, you're stuck with this, you know, defective hardware wrapped around your vagus nerve. The surface electrodes, this is a patient that we actually use. This is a reprogrammable device that's used for stimulating. So the patient feels, because you can sometimes feel a seizure coming on, and they tell it, okay, you know, turn on the stimulator and abort the seizure. One of our patients who was a post-stroke patient had a set of cortical electrodes in there, and you can see the little box window that's been cut out of his skull. It's actually called a skull flap, and so it's taken out, and they put it in a little bucket of saline during the procedure, and then they put it back on again. One of the reasons for mentioning it is it takes a fair amount of real estate on the skull in order to get at the brain. And we're going to put another set of electrodes in there, deep brain electrodes rather than surface electrodes. And without very many of these things, you're going to run out of space on the surface of your head to put electrodes in. You really can't go back into the same place again because you've disturbed it too much. Yeah. This particular type might be in there permanently. Okay, because it's sitting on the surface. It's not poking into it. And it's not looking at very precise locations. So this particular surgery is a simple surgery to do. You make another little window in the skull and you slide these electrodes in so they sit right here on the temporal lobe. So deep brain is a little bit different because deep brain means we're trying to go down to the basal ganglia, not in the cortical regions. So we're going, you know, four to 5 inches deep, and we're doing it blind. You can't really see anything beyond the surface of the brain. So my job basically is to try to make sure that the surgeon gets this thing where he wants it. What you see is the sort of working end of the deep brain stimulation electrode. The typical ones have four little platinum iridium rings on the end of a very flexible cable. And it has to be flexible because the brain is soft and it moves. I just ran across a really nice, you know, 32 electrode device on the end of a long silicon spear, which isn't going to be flexible enough to move. And it's not going to be clinically useful. It might be useful for a short time. Then there's a pulse generator. Basically, the pacemaker generates short pulses. It's reprogrammable externally, and it's connected through an extension cord to the lead that goes into the brain. The extension cord is good because there are failure modes that involve breaking the cable, and you can now go in and replace the extension cable from here to here without major brain surgery, which happens not too infrequently. Here's some more details of the electrode, and in fact I'll pass one around here. So this is my one and only sample here, because they don't like to hand out these samples. And here's the instruction manuals. It's interesting that with every electrode, Medtronic provides an instruction manual for the surgeon, as if the surgeon doesn't really know how to do this. So pass that around. And this particular paper was looking at retrieved electrodes that had not worked for some reason or other to see whether or not they provoked a scar type reaction from the brain. And it turns out it's actually a very thin layer of what's called glial scar around this. So it doesn't really interfere with the transmission of electrical pulses out from the four contacts. You can model this in different ways, and if there was a lot of fluid, you would get different transmission. In fact, I think we have right here, this is a model showing tissue impedance here. You can also model it with a layer of fluid, and you get slightly different transmission properties. The black is really the contacts spaced. In this case, they're spaced further apart than you normally see them. Here's an enlarged contact, and here's a scaled neuron sitting a millimeter or so away from the contact. And the model actually shows that you have a difference in voltage between one side of the neuron and the other, which is what, in fact, triggers it. So this is the down to the cellular level of how this neurostimulation works.
You don't pulse to ground?
You can pulse to ground. You have that option, right? And you get different results that way. There's more interference because you can change the impedance, right? If you get struck by lightning, by the way, these things don't work well. There have also been instances where very high magnetic fields will interfere with them. I'm having an MRI, I'll mention that. But also large elevator motors and such. If you're standing next to the 20 horsepower motor that's running your elevator, it can switch this thing off. And for a pacemaker running your heart, that's very bad. For this, it's only moderately bad because you don't die when it's turned off. Yeah, mostly magnetic. There are some electrostatic effects from X radiation, so even a CT scan is now cautioned. So what are we using them for? Well, we're doing mainly Parkinson's disease, other kinds of tremor, essential tremor and dystonias, and some of these pain syndromes, mostly due to post-stroke pain. These dystonias, tardive dyskinesia is a dyskinesia that's due to over-medication neuroleptic drugs. And then we have a Tourette syndrome patient in the queue. And then there are these interesting psychological things. There's really if you can find a site in the brain that is a very localized site that's the cause of an abnormal clock signal. This is basically what we're doing is we're resetting clocks in the brain. And you can imagine an obsessive compulsive disorder is really trying to do the same thing over and over again because you don't really believe that it's effective. So there's an internal mechanism that you can reset that says, I've done it enough. Okay. And that's the kind of thing that you would be using the electrode for. But what you have to find is the place in the pathway. And for instance, in depression, there's a very long pathway that goes through a number of different nuclei in the brain. Different drugs are effective at different parts of it, but they all affect the same pathway of reward and fear and other kinds of basic emotions that of which, you know, depression is one. So we haven't yet done any depression patients. One of the interesting things in treating that is one of the surgeons has patented the location where he puts his electrodes. So in order to put the electrode in the same place, you have to pay him a royalty. But luckily, there are lots of other places that work just as well, so he's going to end up with nothing. Nobody's going to use his site because he wants to pay a royalty. You know? Okay. There are ethics, but this is the medical industry, see? This is ethical as far as industry goes. So we're going to talk about Parkinson's disease from here on out. And the symptoms of Parkinson's, the most obvious ones are the motor symptoms of tremor and rigidity and slowed gait, motor block or freezing of gait where you can't walk through a doorway without stumbling, basically. And there are a number of other things that as the disease progresses, it affects speech and swallowing ability. Eventually, dementias and other kinds of more global things affect consequences of Parkinson's. And at that point, we can't do anything about those, even though we can still do a treatment that may help the motor symptoms. So you're treating one part of the disease, and you can't really treat the other. There's some selection criteria here that we have to go by. You can't simply treat everybody who has Parkinson's-like symptoms. And it turns out a number of people, and I've seen enough of these MRIs now, to recognize that a lot of us are suffering from brain atrophy. You know, most of us, speaking of suffering, most of us don't know we're suffering from that. We function very well. We have what's called reserve capacity. And so it takes quite a bit of brain loss before you start developing dementias. And I guess this is a good thing. It means that we can function in the world even while things are going wrong. And what part of the brain are we going to work on? Well, the pathway for generating movement begins really in the cortex, where you have the idea of movement. And it follows, though, both directly down the spine and through these regulatory regions that are trying to recruit the right muscles to have the right outcome. Highly practiced movements are different from your first-time practice. There are a whole series of things within the brain that regulate movement. And the one that goes wrong in Parkinson's is the substantia nigra. It has a population of these dopamine neurotransmitter cells, and they are more fragile than most cells in the brain. And whatever the cause, and there's a slight, statistical linkage to familial causes, there's possible toxicity from things like pesticides and such. But you start losing these, and when you've lost maybe 90% of them, the symptoms start to appear. And the outcome is the substantia nigra here is connected to all these other regions. And when its cells are lost, they can't be regulated. So the clock function that was regulating the subthalamic nucleus, which regulates the globus pallidus, which regulates the perpendicular nucleus, and then the putamen, and then the caudate, and on up here into the cortex, all goes haywire. And the most obvious symptoms is the tremor in the hand, which is one of the first things that shows up. And that turns out to be regulated mostly in the subthalamic nucleus. So that's the preferred target for our electrodes these days. And in a brain atlas, this subthalamic nucleus is this little thing here, which is said to be about the size of an almond. It's really about a small almond. The atlas shows dotted lines around it because everybody's different. They can only show what the typical value is. This is the midline of the brain. Here's the ventricles there that are fluid-filled. This is the thalamus here. So I'm not going to go into more details than that. I don't need to know all of these odd things that are labeled in this atlas. There are variations in how the electrodes are implanted, and so I'm going to talk about the particular technique that Dr. Haidt uses at Redwood City. He's the only one who does it there. There's one other Kaiser surgeon in Northern California in Sacramento who does it. There's one at Stanford who does it. There's one at UC San Francisco and the VA there. So this is a rather rare procedure. There's a lot more demand for it than there is supply, which is an interesting thing to think about. My office is right there now. Okay, so part of the process that we have to go through is screening the patients, and it's a fairly lengthy screening procedure down to the point at which they actually get their surgery. And then there's some inpatient care after that, and then it's a repeat process. They have to come back in to have the have the stimulator itself turned on, and then it probably needs reprogramming every 6 months or so. The healthcare industry doesn't deal well with this. They like to cure you and then send you out the door and never see you again. So the bean counters probably have not looked at the fact that the more patients we treat, the more of them they're going to see again. It's really nice to have an effective treatment, but if it's going to add 4 hours of clinical time for each patient every 6 months indefinitely, it's going to be very expensive to do. So we would like to have better ways of, say, using telehealth to regulate, to check on how well your stimulator is working and reprogram it remotely if needed. It is something that we're working on. Dr. Haidt uses a technique used mostly in Europe. And I should mention that 1997 was the first year that FDA approved this in the United States, and that's about 10 years after it had been used on a small scale in Europe. And then it was approved for only one side, and now in 2002 was the soonest that both sides were approved. When it was found that it was very safe to do that. So we're going to aim for getting an accuracy of placement down here in the basal ganglia of the brain within plus or minus half a millimeter, 500 microns, of our intended target. And in order to do that, we use magnetic resonance localization to identify the region. We use fused MRI and CT. We take a ventriculogram, which is a fairly old technique, to identify in the operating room the same structures that you could see on the MRI. And then we take plain X-rays to locate each of our mapping electrodes, because you actually have to measure what the neurons are doing to make sure you've got it in the right place. You do this at known depths, and then you repeat for each track until you finally get it to the place where you think it's going to be most effective. And again, this has a number of different stages. Here's our target again, the subthalamic nucleus. In order to get there, the first thing we have to do is have a hole in the skull. So we make a little 5/8 inch diameter hole. And then we're going to do the ventriculogram, so there has to be a pathway from the exterior of the brain down to what's called the foramen of Monroe. This has nothing to do with Monroe here. It's a different Monroe, some some neuroanatomist in the past. This pathway has to go through no critical structures, mainly through the white matter, because in fact the axons of the white matter can regenerate to a degree, and they can move out of the way better than the cells themselves do. And there have to be no blood vessels or other kind of critical things in the way. So that actually takes a fair amount of time. Then we do the same kind of path planning again for the mapping and DBS electrodes, which go down to this region. So that's the pathway where we usually try to find. We could also put an electrode in the globus pallidus or even in the PPN down here. We're going to have some of our patients get those instead. So here's a little more detailed flow chart for the surgery from the time that we do the patient preparation and the patient in the operating room until finally when the electrode is in place, you may or may not implant on the same day the pulse generator. But each one of these sequences can repeat because you may not find the right place the first time. You do some testing. If it's not the right place, you move a little bit, a millimeter or so, and then you try again. And once we put the permanent electrode in, you can pull that out, move it again if you need to. We've done six tracks, I guess, and decided we couldn't find the right spot. But more than eight at 45 minutes or so per track, and you don't have time to do this. The patient is awake during this time, by the way. The patient has to be able to tell you if they're getting optical effects because the optic tract is not far away from the site that we're using, and effects on their tongue because you can actually make their speech worse rather than better. So we try to avoid either optical or facial effects. This is the screen on the magnetic resonance imager. We use a fairly long protocol. MRIs take a fair amount of time anyway. We use a protocol to try to get 1 millimeter spacing between slices that can take as long. I mean, we usually can get it down to about 7 to 9 minutes. But if we added a few more slices at the top of the head, we would be up into the 15-minute range, and that's too long. There's also a certain amount of radio frequency energy exposure, not just DC magnetic field. The big magnetic field is what everybody is concerned about. But you're pumping radio frequency in to spin the proton axes in water, basically, which is what you image. And that can affect an existing electrode. So if they've already had an electrode of any kind put in there, you have to be very careful you don't start heating up, basically microwaving, the metal that you put into their head. There's some calibration and testing that can be done, and I've actually built this little three-axis millimeter scale test phantom for determining whether or not we actually are getting 1 millimeter slices. And you probably can't see it there, but you can resolve them in this direction better than you can resolve them in that direction. All of this doesn't matter to most people if you're getting an MRI, but it matters to us because we have to have that degree of accuracy to start with, or we're just simply not going to be able to get accuracy at the end. And then because the patients have tremors, they're moving around in these machines. And so I came up with a number of different kinds of positioning devices. These are assembled out of things that are used for other things, like this vacuum bean bag that holds the head still so that you don't jiggle your head up and down that way. And then in the CT, there's a special bracket for holding this in place. And this now has some brackets. Since it's clamped down at the bottom, if you have tremor, you can vibrate around that hinge. And so there's now a set of brackets I should get some pictures of for damping out the motion of the tremor in the CT scanner. Then when we have both sets of images, we fuse them. You basically overlay one right onto the other and use some image mapping, which some of our early colleagues at Rehab R&D worked on. So there's some background that we were familiar with before this. So we come up with a trajectory there. Let me back up. This is using approved software that goes along with the some of the hardware that we're using. Like this is. This particular hardware is a CRW frame, and it's proprietary to Radionics, and Radionics has its own software to use that. There are three, I think, other stereotactic frame manufacturers, not all used in this country. So this little purple line here is the trajectory that we're working on at this point, trying to get down to the region where we're interested. And once you're satisfied with that, well, then the patient can come into the operating room. And Stanford's operating rooms are about twice as big as Kaiser's, and so they have a lot more room in there. What I have to do is actually move out a bunch of stuff, the microscopes and other kinds of equipment, keep the anesthesia machine in there. The sterile region is over here. I put two X-rays into the operating room and clamped them down to the floor because the vibration of the X-ray is going to affect the quality of the image. We have a rack of equipment that has to be close by the patient. The patient's operating table is right there. It's at a 30-degree angle. And there's a floor-mounted pedestal, which you'll see in the other pictures, that anchors the patient down to the floor. And then there's an X-ray printer and work table over here. So while the surgeon is up here doing stuff, I'm over here trying to get the X-ray printer to print and without jamming and, you know, the usual sort of thing. This is during some of our pre-surgery trials, so we had a nice plastic head to work with rather than a real patient. And this shows the head, Herman the head, mounted in a stereotactic ring. So this is bolted to, you know, using little pins screwed into his skull. And the patient's head will be in the same kind of apparatus and bolted down to this floor pedestal here with an X-ray cassette behind to get an image down this way and another X-ray cassette here to get an image from the source that's off in the lateral direction. So here's the lateral view. Here's the AP source. And we'll align those to the nearest half millimeter. This is actually a failure. This little point here is supposed to be right on the crosshair, and it's more than half a millimeter out of line. So I would have had to go back and readjust everything. All that has to be done before the patient gets there, of course. And here we are looking straight into the X-ray source from over the top of the cassette. And then the instruments that we're going to use are a micropositioner, a whole series of attachments for that and cabling and such. And all of this has to be pre-tested and then sterilized. And then a set of guide tubes and some probe microelectrodes. I have one of these probe microelectrodes in this box here, so I'll pass this around. You can look at it. Don't take it out of the box. This one actually has, I'll push down the, this is a coaxial one. It has a center electrode, which has a microscopic tip. So you actually cannot see the tip of this. That the last, again, half millimeter is invisible to the eye. So that's what's in this box right here. And then the guide tubes, there's one set of guide tubes for the mapping electrodes and another set of guide tubes for the permanent electrode. So we first map and then we implant the permanent electrode. And then in the operating room, we have the specialty team, and there's me and the surgeon. I should have put my title in bold, and the surgeon can be in little type, but we'll give him equal billing here. There's also hospital staff. Okay, so there, Kaiser has an interesting arrangement in that the billing is all internal. So we get paid out of a different budget than the hospital staff, and the hospital staff is all union and has a whole set of rules of its own, which are so arcane that I couldn't tell you, you know, what their work rules are. And then radiology is there to help us get things started and when the printer jams. And perioperative services means the people who do the sterilization and then do the cleanup afterwards. Once we have everything sterile and opened, we do another test to see if the stereotactic frame aligns properly. So this target here has to be aligned within plus or minus half a millimeter. In fact, usually it's within plus or minus 0.2. And then Dr. Height here is putting the stereotactic arc onto the ring, so it bolts onto the ring, which is bolted to the patient. And here's our ventriculogram. So what the good doctor has done is inject 2 milliliters of this contrast agent into the ventricles, and it fills the fluid replaces the X-ray transparent fluid in the ventricles. And the part that we're actually looking for to correspond with the MRI image is called the posterior commissure. So there's a little band of tissue that crosses one of the ventricles right in the back there. And that's in fairly close to the same place for everybody. And that's one of the markers for the anatomic axis. The other is the anterior commissure, which is usually not so visible, but we can still detect it. So that's the landmark that everybody uses for trying to locate something within the brain. And then once the patient has a burr hole, I bypassed the burr hole. You have to do that before you do the ventriculogram. So we take the ventriculogram stuff off, and we put on the micropositioner, and now we can run the microelectrodes, the mapping electrodes, in and out. And then if we don't find the right place, this has an XY stage right here, you can shift another millimeter or two in any direction. So here's the micropositioner, here's the mapping electrode, and the region that we're going to be interested in is right in there. So from this point on, I'm looking at these X-rays and measuring relative positions. And what we're doing, here's our coaxial electrode, and here's some not to scale neurons. We're not actually doing intracellular nerve potential measurements. These are near field potentials. We actually measure a dozen or so neurons, which, again, the good doctor can hear these better than I can see them on the screen. So this is usually an audio detection of what those neurons are. I have some illustrations in a minute that will, you can see the different kinds of them. And then the rack of equipment has the display and the amplifiers and the noise limiters and such that we need. It has the micropositioner depth and depth control. So this is all in a rack that's sitting next to the patient. And you can see a neuron signal there. So it is possible to pick up individual neurons. As you move up and down a tract, you're going to see different kinds of firing patterns. So the neurosurgeon doing this kind of thing has these memorized as to where you expect to find them. Here's a set that are firing in synchronously with the tremor. So this set is important. And then you get down to the substantia nigra. So here you're in the subthalamic nucleus, down below that is too deep. And if you're putting the electrode in the globus pallidus, you go through these different layers with these different kinds of cells until you finally reach the globus pallidus interna, which is the region that you want. And while the good doctor is listening to those and calling out the different kinds of cells that he sees, I'm measuring electrode position. So this is actually an overlay of two images. One is the original first track, and then the next is the track that we're working on now. And we're picking off these dimensions so that he could see how far the electrode actually moved. Because when you look at this electrode that's going around, you can see how thin it is. And it doesn't take anything but the near presence of a blood vessel to divert it as it's being pushed in and out. So within the last 40 millimeters, this sub-millimeter electrode is flexible enough, it can bend, and it does. And that's the one reason for doing all this repetitive X-ray and such, to try to find out how much it bent and where it went. And when you're all done, you take your first electrode track and you put it in the center of this surgeon's eye map, and then each successive one, you have the place that he picked, a millimeter, in this case, anterior, 4 millimeters anterior, 4 millimeters anterior and 2 medial, and then I give him the number that shows exactly where it went compared to what his settings were. And then based on the results, he picks the place to put the permanent electrode. And again, we're looking at the same kind of information but displayed down the length of the paths of the mapping electrodes. So there's 3 mapping electrodes. And we note whether the cells are in blue, connected to the arm, in other words, the patient's arm when it's moved, or is there a question back there?
This might be a silly question, but how do you give the electrical direction?
Well, up or down is there's a lead screw that moves it up or down. In order to move any direction lateral in the brain, okay, good question, because you're thinking, what happens if you move this while it's still in the brain? This is not good. You pull it all the way back out, reset the XY stage, and then you put it all the way back in again. So that's why it takes 45 minutes or so per track. And fortunately, the brain is pretty forgiving on this. I'm sure that people, you know, if you examined them at enough detail, you would find that they had forgotten their third birthday party or something like this. But mostly, they don't have any effects at all. And that's partly due to good planning, because you could go a little bit, the part of the caudate, for instance. If you hit the caudate, you're going to have all kinds of problems. I don't know what they are, but it's potentially fatal. So we never hit the caudate, even though it's sitting right nearby. Yeah, it's just a couple of little screws there. It would be nice to have something where you could just punch it in and it would move to the right direction. And yeah, we don't want any oopses. Okay, so you can see there's some arm cells that have been found, some leg cells. These are connected to either passive or active movement of the joints or touching the skin. And if you touch the skin on the face and you pick up some head cells, are there any head cells in here? No, I think not. There's one right there, a little. So that one's connected to the head. So it means that you've stimulated the head. So you're picking up this sensory map, basically, that corresponds to the motor map that also goes through the same region. So once we have all those, the surgeon decides he's going to put the permanent electrode in, and the four contacts are now here along the length of that line. There's another way of displaying the same information in a more, representative view. So here's basically a transparency of the electrode overlaid onto the mapping tracks. And back in the back here is PC. This is the posterior commissure again that gives you the positional reference. So this is the origin of the anatomic axis right there. And what I do is give the programmers who are over in Walnut Creek or Hayward, we're going to be turning on and setting the pulse widths and rates and voltages, this information, and it tells them that if they want to do something about the arm tremor, well, this 0, 1, 2, and 3 electrodes, so the number 1 electrode is the one that's closest to those cells. And that's information you can't get unless you, for most places in the country that are doing this, they're simply assuming that the electrode is exactly where they intended it, and they aren't actually measuring that. And it's good enough because you can always boost the voltage. So when you turn on the signal, you're affecting about a 2-millimeter sphere around each contact, and you can run the voltage up to about 7 volts, okay, which affects a much bigger sphere, which has many more cells being affected by it than the ones that you intended, so you now can't do that. It also runs the battery down. The battery is surgically implanted, can be unplugged and replaced by another relatively simple surgical procedure. The battery life, if you run the voltage way up, is going to be only about 3 years. If you can keep the voltage low because you've got it in exactly the right place, 7 years is a good battery life. Another good question. About a kilo-ohm. And so we take a final X-ray to show that, yes, indeed, we got it somewhere down there, and it's now been capped off here. There's a little device that looks like a pop-top that goes over that hole in the skull and snaps closed and holds the electrode there. And we have found that sometimes that moves the electrode half a millimeter, just snapping the thing closed. So, again, we have to make sure we know where it is even after we think it's all done. And here's some CT scan that we'll do the next day, showing here's a bilateral electrodes, and one of these has been connected up, and the other one hasn't been connected up yet. So they're different pulse generators. Here's a mock-up of a pulse generator. This one provides outputs for both the left and right electrodes, and some of them provide only one side or the other, so you might have two of these devices in there. And then here's an MRI risky though it may be, showing the four contacts down in there. So this is the only way you can get a reference back to the brain itself. Here in a CT scan, you can only reference it to the bony landmarks. And the brain shifts. And in fact, going back a little bit, Okay, see, there's a little bit of curvature in there. I'm doing a study now because we have 14, I think, cases in which we have the first side done and then 2 weeks later do the second side. It's called a staged implant. And there's changes in this curvature between one time and the next. You know, the brain has swollen a little bit because, you know, we've messed with it. Who knows what other reasons for having brain shift. Drilling a little hole in here changes the internal pressure, which we're very careful to make sure that cerebrospinal fluid doesn't leak out, because the more of that, the more likely you are to get air into the electrode tract. So there's something going on here that causes curvature, and yet we don't see very much movement of the electrodes themselves. And the question is, well, what's moving? You know, if you have to come up with a little bit of extra length in order to have that curvature form. And it hasn't really been looked at by anybody, as far as I know.
So you're saying that the MRI, because of the magnetic field, might move the electrode?
Well, no. It would be nice to be able to do an MRI on all of these, but it's so risky that it's only done in an emergency. And the reason is that this is a little antenna, basically. And it's picking up that radio frequency signal, not the magnetic field. So it starts to heat up. And the same problem happens with aneurysm clips and with the coils that are used for filling aneurysms. They're all conductive, and they all absorb some of the radio frequency energy. And heating up to half a degree C is allowable. You're not killing cells by heating half a degree C. So you have to keep the energy absorption in that antenna low enough to avoid that. So here's one of those single-sided pulse generators, and I'm testing it basically on the bench. Here's a little petri dish filled with gel, which is substituting for the brain, and we're using the pulse generators now with the to see the input pulse, the capacitively coupled pulse, and in the immediate region surrounding it, and then this is a distant region further away. So you can pick the signals up even if they're not at a distance, even if they're not high enough to stimulate cells. And then the whole thing is, does it really work? Well, there's a small percentage of complications. You might actually puncture a blood vessel and cause a small stroke. But those are no different from other kinds of brain surgery. So that's usually 5% or less of those kinds of complications. And the patients are, before this surgery, on high levels of medication. And so the real measure as to whether it works or not is, can you get them off medication? Most of them can't go off it entirely, but they can go off it with the minimal medication, they're doing much better. So this is what's called the universal Parkinson's disease something score. And the higher it is, the worse their motor function is. So they may start off with no medication, and they're up here in the 50s, 40s to 60s. And with medication, it comes down, okay, but still not very good. And here we have the DBS alone brings it down into the 25 or so. Here at Stanford, this is more of Dr. Height's work, and he's down in the 15 or less, and it's stable over time. So this is in fact a good result. You're able to reduce the symptoms, because the UPDRS is a symptomatic measure. So that's what we're able to accomplish with this. It's a prosthesis. It doesn't cure the disease. But what the patients are told is that the good results consist of rolling your symptoms back about 5 years. And so you get 5 years, whatever your symptoms were 5 years ago, you should be back at that same place again. And so this is what we're doing. This is brain surgery. And, you know, it takes a few people to do this. And, of course, the whole point of it is to improve the state of the art. One of the reasons I like to show this Hieronymus Bosch painting is that not only do they dress sort of funny, but there's a gallows on the hillside back here. And they took medical malpractice seriously in those days. Okay, so are there any other questions?
The pulse generator is actually right next to the brain.
No, it's down here in the shoulder. Okay, and for a heart pacemaker, they would put it down in the abdomen. You've got lots of room down there, but just under the clavicle is where these things get put.
So the only thing in the brain is
the little wire and the contacts.
What's the pulse rate typically?
180 per minute. Yeah, and the pulse width is maybe 60 microseconds. Very short pulses. And these are bipolar pulses, so it has a high positive and then a longer negative pulse following that.
So pulses applied continuously?
Yeah.
The person's awake or he can turn off?
They're given, first of all, a little magnet to turn it on and off. Okay, so some people don't use it when they sleep, and then the batteries last longer. Some people need it when they sleep because they have restless legs, which is another symptom of this. But you can also give them a little programmer, and the little instruction manual has it mentioned there. I don't actually do this because I'm stuck in the surgery, so I don't have to worry about what they do. But what you can do is you can set it so that the patient has a certain range that they can do. And a certain number of patients who have sort of compulsive issues, even though they've got Parkinson's as their main disease, they may have a little bit of compulsion in there, and they become known as fiddlers. Because if you give them the control, they sit and play with it, you know, and they run their pulse rate up and they run it down and they run it in and out. Yeah. And they don't get any better result out of it. It's just, you know, that's what they do. Yes?
What's the
average length of the operation? Well, we're set up to do one a week. And last year we did 38. And that's 20-something patients, because some of them are staged and they're not all done. We don't do both sides at the same time. The guy in Sacramento does both sides at the same time almost always because he doesn't do this intraoperative X-ray, which takes longer. And I get there at 7 in the morning. The patient gets to CT at about 8:30, gets into the operating room about 9:30 because it takes us an hour to do that mapping. It takes about an hour to get the burr hole and get to the point of getting the ventriculogram. And so by 12:30, we've done the first mapping track. And if you're really lucky, that first mapping track's the one you're going to implant. And so you take out that mapping electrode and you put in the permanent electrode. And an hour later, so from the patient's in from 8:30 to 1:30, that's about as fast as it's ever gone. But the more mapping tracks, the more ground failures, because this is one of the things I learned at Stanford in my thermodynamics class is how to do good thermocouples with proper grounding. And at that time, I was having trouble with my girlfriend, and I didn't have a place to live, and I worried about my tuition. But I went to that class, and that's a good thing because that's something I've used ever since. And here we have, you know, big ground cables we can ground the bed, and we can ground everything if we need to. The instruments are sensitive enough. You can pick up cell phone transmissions. We tell everybody to, within 20 feet of the operating room, to turn off their cell phones. They're going to put in a Wi-Fi network in the operating rooms for us, and we're going to tell them, you know, if it exceeds, let's see, it's 100 microwatts per square centimeter radio frequency, noise, basically, and that's a large enough noise that we would start picking up that on the mapping electrodes, and it would be in the same range as the signal-to-noise ratio that we're looking at. Okay. It originally has a tungsten wire stylet down the center of it that you use to push it down in, and you withdraw that. Okay, so now it becomes very flexible. Has this helical wound wire inside a polyurethane tube,
and
which is not stiff, very flexible. So it's stiff when you put it in. You take the stylet out. You cannot put the stylet back in again. Okay, so it means that you can, if you're too deep, you can pull it back a little bit. Okay, but if you've got to go deeper, you've got to start all over again. Yep. Yes. Ah. There is the crucial question. If we knew more about it, we'd be able to tell the programmers, you know, here's the settings that you need to use. But it works a little, it works basically like the heart pacemaker, in that if your heart is tachycardia means a fast heart rate. Okay, and if you want to slow it down, you hit it with a big pulse, and it hyperpolarizes the cells, and they can't fire as quickly. So you can now regulate it by the latency after the first pulse that you hit it with. And so now you can give it a slower pulse rate than it would naturally fire. On the other hand, if it's firing too slow and you hit it with a pulse, it's going to fire it right then, and it's going to fire it for the next pulse and then the next pulse. So what you're basically doing is taking this little clump of cells and telling them, you're all going to fire in this sequence. And since they're firing too fast, or at least cells connected to them are firing too fast and causing this tremor, which is due to firing, you know, flexors and extensors alternately, okay. So now you can say, you know, we want to fire those motor units more slowly and in a more regulated fashion. But that's all anybody knows. That we're basically playing with the internal clocks here. And when you talk about the biological clock, you think of one kind of biological clock, you know, that's the daytime, you know, diurnal cycles. But you've got all these internal clocks that are doing things like regulating walking up and down stairs. Because that's a very cyclic event. And one of the things we studied, Dave and I, when we were working on human body movement analysis at the VA, and we did some Parkinson's patients there too, so we had some movement analysis background. But Parkinson's patients may have terrible time walking, you know, over normal ground. And some of them, when they hit a stair step, it's a different clock. And so they'll be able to walk up the stairs with no problem. As soon as they get to the top, they're back to shuffling again. Okay, because they have two different pathways for doing foot motion. You know, one regular walking and one stair steps. And one pathway doesn't work and the other pathway does. Mm-hmm.
You talked about it being stable over time.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the last slide it showed up to 12 months.
Right. Long-term studies, there's lots of five-year studies have been published showing that it's, and you do have the opportunity to reprogram. So that's one of the advantages of this. I didn't even mention that prior to doing this, they used a technique called pallidotomy. So they would put an electrode into the globus pallidus and heat it up well beyond what you would see in the, in the artifact due to MRI and burn that out. So that was something that was irreversible. And here you've got a nice reversible tool for trying to tailor the input to the continuing progress of the disease. So 5 years there's published data. There are 10 years there's a small number of patients. But more than that, in this country, since we've only done it since 97, you aren't going to see anything more than that. Yes. Okay. That's most evident when a patient has Parkinson's related dementia. Okay, because their motor symptoms are so disabling, and the social effects of having Parkinson's motor symptoms are so obvious that you really don't see a whole lot of these dementias. As soon as you fix their motor problems, those dementias are their dominant problem now. And it means that they can walk now, but they don't walk in the direction they thought they were going to because they're lost, you know. So that's really an issue. Originally, there were some studies which said that, oh, well, this is causing dementia. No, it's not causing it, but the dementia was there all along. It's part of the progression of the disease. Yeah. Yeah. One of the other things that is part of our selection criteria is to look at family support. Because we've had a patient who was an ideal candidate, and her husband hated Kaiser. He wasn't going to have anything to do with us implanting anything in his wife. You know? Most of the time, it's people who live alone and who have no... I mean, you probably shouldn't be driving if you have this kind of Parkinson's disease, but people do anyway. So if you have social support networks, we would put you higher up in the rank of getting one of these things than if you don't. It's an interesting... I mean, we run into all these issues that have to do with our you know, societies dealing with the problems of aging, you know, and people that we could help, we can't help because they have some other issue like that. Okay?
Okay. Eric, thank you very
sure.
much. How many people are queasy after that? Okay, you probably want your samples returned.
Yes. Yeah, we turn it off.